Two fires in the Lolo National Forest are being fueled by wind. That's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Good evening, I'm Corin Cates-Carney. The Montana wood products industry has had its strongest six-month period in 5 years, and Edward O'Brien talks with a Montana-based Ebola researcher about the unfolding outbreak in West Africa. Two fires in the Lolo National Forest are burning actively due to gusting winds. The Howard Creek fire has grown 12 acres. Currently, there is no threat to buildings or structures. The other fire on the Superior Ranger District in the Lozo Bridge area is about 10 acres. Forest Service spokesman Boyd Hartwig says the cause of that fire is not yet known.
It looks like two structures, abandoned trailers possibly, were lost during the initial stage of that fire. So aircraft are on that fire, and they've sent engines and firefighters up there. They've been on that fire for a while. But again, both of these fires are sort of wind-driven events. And so hopefully once the wind kind of drops a little bit, you know, things will start to improve.
Hartwig says that fire crews are making tactical plans in their initial attacks on the fires. In other news from around the state, a forest expert at UM Bureau of Business and Economic Research says Montana wood products industry just had its strongest six-month period in 5 years. Director of Forestry Industry Research Todd Morgan says wages rose 20% since the beginning of 2014, along with 3% increase in production workers and a 4% increase in lumber production for Montana sawmills.
And I think that has a lot to do with more of the mills in the state are getting back closer to full-time employment among their employees. For a long time, for several years, 3-4 years or more, they were running curtailed shifts or shortened shifts, but most of the mills are not running overtime or anything like that yet.
Morgan says the modest growth is encouraging, but U.S. home building hasn't recovered from the Great Recession as quickly as experts predicted, and that directly impacts wood production, which has been in recovery mode since 2009, when numbers were at their lowest since the end of World War II.
It was a major impact. The combination of the recession we had and that domestic home building collapse, really. You know, that just, you know, in 2005, 2006, we built almost 2 million new homes in the U.S. And, you know, the long-term average is closer to 1.4 million new homes a year. And we're not back to that point yet.
Most of the growth occurred in the lumber production side of the industry, which is the most common in Montana. It rose 40% from the all-time low in 2009. A June fire at the Plum Creek Fiberboard plant in Columbia Falls hurt production of panel wood products. Morgan says lumber production could be higher, but a limited supply of raw timber is holding back its recovery.
There's a couple things going on. Part of it is the number of loggers and log trucks available right now is less than it was, say, before the recession, before the wood products downturn. So not as many of those people have returned to work yet. And then there's the supply picture. That has to do with how much timber is being harvested on private lands and public lands, or that's being offered for sale and then being harvested.
After seeing no growth in the industry for several years, Morgan says the moderate increases are promising and more likely to be sustainable than dramatic gains. Presidents from the West Africa countries hit the Ebola outbreak are meeting with world health leaders to come up with ways to stop the spreading of the deadly disease. The World Health Organization has announced its launching of a new joint $100 million response plan to the outbreak that has killed at least 729 people in four countries. This is the largest recorded outbreak of Ebola in history and has prompted fears the disease could spread beyond Africa's borders. Scientists at the Rocky Mountain Laboratories in western Montana's Bitterroot Valley are a key part of the global effort to develop an Ebola vaccine. Dr. Heinz Fieldman is the chief of RML's Laboratory of Virology in Hamilton. Fieldman says Ebola is a rare viral infection, one that initially presents rather mundane symptoms, including skin rash, sore throat, muscle aches, fever, and chills. Eventually, Ebola patients experience diarrhea, delirium, rampant bleeding, organ failure, and a shock syndrome. At that point, death is usually not far behind. There are five different strains of Ebola, and the one responsible for the current outbreak has a 70% to 90% fatality rate. It takes direct physical contact with bodily fluids to transmit the disease. Edward O'Brien recently asked Fieldman why Ebola outbreaks tend to cluster in African countries.
So Ebola is something that we call a zoonotic pathogen. That means it comes from an animal reservoir And then, in fact, mammalian or other mammalian species, such as the human. So in this case, we believe Ebola comes from bats, even though there is still some dispute, but that is the general belief. Wherever you find Ebola, it's primarily in those areas where those reservoirs are living. So bats are all over the world, but this is the most diverse group of mammals that we have. So certain bats live in certain areas, and so the reservoirs for Ebola are supposed to be living in Central Africa. So that's why you see these in Africa, and there has to be a transmission from this reservoir into humans or into, you know, other animal species such as the great apes. What we're seeing with Ebola is when then one of those patients comes into a healthcare setting that is in bad condition, improperly set up, and then human-to-human transmission occurs. So whatever we see reported as Ebola or as Ebola outbreaks is not the primary transmission event. It is the secondary event or tertiary event when human-to-human transmission occurs. And that is largely driven by improper measurements in healthcare systems. That's why you do not see Ebola primarily, let's say, in the U.S., because at least as far as we know, there is no known reservoir. So if Ebola would have come into the U.S., it would be likely through an infected person. So the fact that you see them in Africa is not just because it's Africa. It's because the reservoir is living in certain parts in Africa.
Dr. Feldman, I'm reading that Minnesota has a relatively large Liberian population. So according to what you're saying, we shouldn't necessarily be so concerned about a visitor from, say, Liberia bringing this back to Minnesota in this case and wreaking havoc, starting an outbreak here.
Yeah, the history of what we call imported infections has really taught us we have to be cautious and we have to be prepared, but we don't have to be worried about a patient coming into this country. Our healthcare system is so sophisticated in these basic rules that we are much better off than any of these hospitals in developing countries. So if a patient would come with an unknown illness, particularly if it's an infectious or if the cause is most likely infectious, there won't be any nurse in this country that is not going to put gloves on and that is not going to put some protection on, because we have it available, we are set up, they have to follow protocols. And these basic measurements will prevent an outbreak. And if we go back, we didn't have many introductions yet of Ebola, even so, or Marburg, even so we had a few, but we have had quite a few more from Lassa fever, which is causing a similar infectious disease, even though it's a different virus. In all of those cases, and most of them were fatal, we had no secondary cases. So this really shows that what we have established in developing countries, and in this country in particular, is going to protect us for this kind of a scenario. But you are completely right. There is always, not just now, always the possibility that a traveler from an area where this virus has been identified, which we call endemic area, if a traveler comes back, there is always the potential that this person could have picked up that infection. So I think if people are really worried about this, I don't blame them. But I think hopping on an airplane today is a much bigger risk than being afraid of an Ebola patient that comes into a country such as the U.S.
You and your colleagues are working on a vaccine, correct?
That's one of our research areas, yes.
Yeah. In layman terms that somebody as unsophisticated as I could understand, what can you tell us about it? How close are we?
Our approach, as well as some others from colleagues, we've done all the experimental work. So there are several candidate vaccines that are ready to go into human application, because there's not much more that we can do on the animal side. We're still working on understanding why and how these vaccines are working. So these are more research academic questions, but we have established that these vaccines do work in the animal models. So the next step, and this is where most of the approaches are stuck, is to move this forward, do the necessary toxicity and safety tests in phase one clinical trials, which is in humans. It's a small group of humans, the volunteers, that are willing to take these vaccines, and where people only look for adverse effects. Is there anything happening? And then the next step would be phase two, which would basically look into the immune responses in humans. Once those two things are done, then we could most likely apply for at least preliminary licensing, and then we could apply them to outbreak situations and use them. These studies are not cheap. The other thing is the money itself is not necessarily the problem. It's more the prioritization on how to spend money in the public health system. Ebola is a very rare disease. The people that have the funding and have the money available, of course, they don't have all the money in the world, and they have to prioritize, and they have to make a decision. Are we going to put this money into developing these vaccines further, or are we going to put this money into HIV, influenza, something else? That is a big burden for our public health system.
From a philosophical, from an ethical perspective, why not bring this unfinished product to West Africa and deploy it right now, going on the argument that something is better than nothing?
The situation in West Africa at the moment, and this is based on my discussion with colleagues in the field and friends in the field, is everybody says that the situation locally is not suitable for any intervention therapy that uses an experimental drug. This may be hard to believe, but these are experts, these are people that are working there, that are people that are trying to help, and if they all warning, I think we need to take that seriously. They have multiple reasons for this. It starts with the terrible conditions in those hospitals and wards. They're totally overfilled, the staff is overworked. They have multiple sites to deal with, which is unusual, which has never happened before. Their personnel is stretched very thin, and they have long hours to work. And then on top of it, the population is very critical and is opposing a lot of the help and assistance. So I think the situation is just not right. On top of it, we need a request from the home country. Without such a request, we can't bring in anything. And that, to my knowledge, has not happened. The third aspect is the legal side. It is, to a certain degree, of course, dangerous to bring in something that has never been in humans. Whoever owns the rights on that vaccine platform or treatment option is, of course, very sensitive to that. There could be legal issues if there is adverse effects associated with the treatment and so on. So there's multiple layers that make this very difficult. It may still not satisfy you and others, but that is currently the situation. And then on top of it is we just don't have enough. This is a very critical situation for West Africa, the countries itself, and the global public health. And I hope, you know, the attention that this gets now and the critical questions being asked, why is no experimental approach being pushed forward, that this will change the prioritization of measurements and that we hopefully will have a vaccine available for the next outbreak or a treatment option. I guess we have to keep our hopes up. A lot of us are frustrated, but we can't give up our hope that hopefully next time we will be prepared and have something.
Dr. Heinz Feldman, thank you so much for your time today and, of course, the important work you and your colleagues in Montana and across the country and the world are doing to tackle these terrible and confounding diseases. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Heinz Feldman is chief of the Laboratory of Virology at the Rocky Mountain Laboratories in Hamilton. Tonight across our listening area, there is a chance of scattered rain showers and thunderstorms with lows in the upper 40s to mid-50s. Tomorrow you can expect cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and thunderstorms, highs 80 to 90. Those thunderstorms may carry on through tomorrow night. Sunday we'll see more of the same with clouds in the sky and a chance of rain and thunderstorms. High Sunday will reach from the mid-80s to low 90s. And now for the editorial comments of Sarah Howell.
Last week, a 3-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that people living in states with federally facilitated insurance marketplaces are ineligible to receive subsidies for insurance because a clause in the Affordable Care Act states those premium tax credits are only available, quote, through an exchange established by the state, end quote. In fact, the law allows for states to set up their own exchanges, but if they choose not to, the federal government is charged with doing so on their behalf. This ruling comes just as I was getting used to the idea that the ACA is indeed law of the land. 4 years after the law passed, 2 years after the Supreme Court ruled that the law is constitutional, after 54 failed attempts in the House to repeal the law, and after more than 8 million Americans became newly insured. So, first things first, what does this mean for Montanans who have purchased affordable health coverage through the federal exchange? In short, nothing. There's no immediate impact on anyone who is newly covered. Here in Montana, nearly 37,000 people were able to purchase health insurance on the exchange, and 86% received financial assistance in the form of subsidies or tax credits. These folks will continue to have access to quality, affordable health coverage, regardless of the D.C. Circuit Court ruling. In the long run, many experts anticipate that this ruling will be overturned by the full D.C. Circuit Court, following a review of the panel's decision. Indeed, shortly after the D.C. Court ruled that subsidies are illegal in 36 states, the Fourth Circuit upheld the legality of those same subsidies in a related case. At its heart, this lawsuit is just another conservative attack attempting to repeal and sabotage the Affordable Care Act. The ACA was passed by Congress in March of 2010. Since then, we have seen dozens and dozens of attempts to roll back the law, both in Congress and at the ballot box. These attempts have all failed because, despite conservative rhetoric, most Americans agree that our healthcare system needed reform, and that all our neighbors and community members deserve access to care, regardless of income. Now we're seeing conservative operatives using the judicial system to try to accomplish what they could not do legislatively or electorally. The argument this lawsuit and several similar suits are making is that the ACA was written in a narrow way to offer subsidies for insurance only through state-run insurance marketplaces, and therefore the subsidies offered in 36 states through the federal exchange are illegal. This argument just doesn't hold water. When you put the argument into the context of the entire ACA, and not one sentence from the bill, it makes no sense whatsoever. Other sections of the ACA empower the Secretary of Health and Human Services to step in and run an exchange when a state opts out. Furthermore, the ACA's ability to offer health care to millions of Americans is firmly rooted in Congress's intent to create subsidies to defer the costs of insurance. This is an essential part of the law. Congress clearly intended both federal and state exchanges to use the tax subsidy as a means for Americans to be able to afford health care. Without this provision, the ACA would not work, and Congress did not intend for the law to fail. For 3 judges to assume that Congress's intention was something other than to make insurance affordable for all Americans would be laughable if it wasn't so offensive. To celebrate this ruling, as some conservative leaders are doing, is to celebrate a scenario in which millions of lower and middle income families are faced with losing health care coverage, paying higher taxes, and seeing their insurance premiums skyrocket. To celebrate this ruling is to acknowledge that years into the health care reform process, some elected officials want nothing more than to stand in the way of meaningful progress in an ongoing effort to ensure that no American goes without access to health care. Meanwhile, here in Montana, some state legislators continue to do just that, stand in the way, as we work toward a Montana solution on Medicaid expansion. Despite the nearly 40,000 Montanans who have purchased insurance through the exchange, some 70,000 remain uninsured and without any options for affordable health care. Medicaid expansion would change that. It's time we lay this issue to rest. All Montanans deserve access to health care without facing debt or bankruptcy. We know what needs to be done and how to do it. Now we need the courage and conviction to move beyond obstructionism and delay and stand up for our families, neighbors, and communities. I'm Sarah Howell with Montana Women Vote. Thanks for listening, and have a terrific weekend.
Sarah Howell is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Corin Cates Carney. Thanks for listening, and please have a good weekend.